Welcome, Red Eyes members. Thank you very much for joining us. It's good to have you with us. We are talking with Terry Boardman. We're talking about Steiner. We're talking about the New World Order. We're talking about the church, the importance or differences, I guess, as well, between the East and the West, what has happened in history, where kind of we are going. And in this second hour here, I definitely want to get into continuing the narrative, as it were, that Terry has been on here and talking about this from a historical perspective, as we kind of move forward in time and see where we are at now, and potentially even then what we could see happen in the next period, or how this will resolve itself. And Terry, you were talking just about this very interesting thing about the life of a child when we kind of broke off there. Tell us a little bit more about that, and recap that for us briefly. What we talked about, that you divided up the life of a child in sets of 33s. Is that correct? And the development in a child's life?
No, the 33 is the 3 times 33 and a third makes a century.
Yes.
So the key thought here is that one can compare one century in the life of humanity as a whole, to one year in the life of a child.
Ah, I got you. All right.
Yeah?
Yes.
So the life of the child goes through various stages. And the interesting thing is, of course, because all of us go through these stages, whether we're Eskimo, Chinese, African, European, whatever. All children, for example, go through the three stages of learning in the first 3 years. Interestingly enough, these three archetypal gestures of walking, speaking, and thinking. Those three things. We've all learned to do that. Yeah, we all did that. And then we all, around about the seventh year of our lives, sometimes a little earlier, some people, but we all changed our teeth. We all dropped our milk teeth, and we all grew our own teeth. That's the marker for the next phase, yeah? Around about the seventh year of life. And then the other thing we all did, traditionally, Hendrik, this was usually placed around about the 14th year. But again, these days, because of modern civilization, it's getting younger and younger. But you will not find any children who experience puberty before the ninth or the tenth year.
That's right.
Yeah. And you don't usually find any kids who experience it as late as, say, the 18th or the 19th year. It's usually between the 12th and the 14th year. And traditionally, it was seen as the 14th year. So these are 7 year phases, do you see? The change of the teeth at 7, puberty at 14, and then comes the more subtle one. Change of teeth is very gross, very physical. Puberty is still physical, but less gross, less hard, so to speak, and more internal, the changes of the emotions and all of that, which happens with the teenager. But when you come to 21, around 20 or 21, then, I don't know about in Sweden, but I think in many countries in Europe, certainly here in England, that was the time where traditionally you were given the key of the house.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You're given the key of the house, which means that you are now a responsible person. You're now a responsible social adult. You're in charge of your own destiny. You can come and go as you please. And, of course, in terms of the law, you're recognized in law as a householder, voting, marriage, all the rest of it, yeah?
Right, right.
In Japan, it's 20. But that's still that's still the 20th year, so to speak. Sorry, the 21st year, yeah? So the age of 21st year. But it's, you see what I mean? It's
yes.
The same time. It's approximately the same markers, 7, 14, 21. So we have a sevenfoldness there.
And then even next up from that, we have about 29. That's even in astrological terminology, the Saturn return and all of this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, 28 and 29 is slightly different, actually. That's a different thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As you say, 29 is the Saturn return. That's one thing. But the sevenfoldness is something slightly different, yeah?
All right.
So this sevenfoldness you will find in ancient esoteric teachings everywhere, the notion that seven is related to time. But the interesting thing here that Steiner brings forward is this other rhythm, this new rhythm, if you will, since the time of Christ, yeah, which has been inscribed into humanity. And again, this is even, and the reason why I'm convinced of this is that because I've looked at other cultures, the histories of other cultures where one can see these phenomena born out, which were ostensibly not Christian cultures, do you see? Mm. Obviously, for the one I know best is Japan, but one can look at China, one can look at India, and you can see similar gestures. And what I mean by that is you look at the 7th century, look at the 9th century, because that's an interesting time, what happens in the child at the age of 9, in the 9th year. Right? Mm-hmm. Very subtle changes go on in the 9th year. And it's interesting, for example, the death process begins in the 9th year, because the death begins at the age of 9 when your brain cells begin to die.
Hmm.
So, you know, the human being obviously is born and advances towards death, but there are these two poles, the death process and the birth process, they advance towards each other, so to speak. And the death pole begins in the human being already then in the 9th year, and the first part that begins to die is the brain, interestingly enough.
Hmm. Didn't know that. That's interesting.
And then, of course, that death process then builds and builds and builds through life until, obviously, finally we do die. But it's the 9th century, right? So if you look at what happens in human in the 9th century in different parts of the world, it's very interesting. I haven't got time to go into all of that, so just recommend it to your listeners, yeah?
Do you have more information about that on your website or in one of your books?
Yes, indeed, yeah, mm-hmm. On my website, yeah.
Brilliant.
And if you bear in mind what I said earlier about the Council of 869, mm-hmm. This is also in the 9th century,
That's right.
This is where in Europe the human being was, as it were, Steiner uses the radical expression, the abolition of the spirit. That's perhaps a little bit too radical, but you see what he's saying, that the church said the individual does not have a spirit anymore. You're cut off from the life of the spirit. So this is really pushing the human being down into earthly dimension. And many children around that age begin to feel that they're separate from their parents. That's where you start to have rather subtle feelings of the child, of insecurity, that maybe my parents are not my parents.
Right.
This kind of thing, yeah?
Mm.
And another thing that happens at that time is it's around that time when your breathing is trying to come into order as a child. Yeah? From birth to 7, your breathing is not in order. But from 7 to 14, this is the time when your breathing is trying to come into order. It's a time of harmony and disharmony within the soul life and in the physiology. It's a complex issue, but the point is that's an important point time, ninth. And then 14 and finally 21, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And Steiner points out that what happens at the change at 7, Henrik, is that we, as it were, that the change of the teeth is a marker that we have grown our own life body, so to speak. We have our physical body from our mothers when we're born, and we've grown our own life body. That body which just supports our life. That's our plant body, if you will.
Right.
And then by 14, forgive me, I'm having to, you know, really do this pretty shorthand, but we'll go into great, much more detail. And at 14, that's when we have grown our, as it were, our, what's called in the esoteric sciences, our astral body, our body of feeling.
Right.
Yeah. That's our animal body, which we share with the animals. Yeah. And then we see that from 14 to 21, the teenager then really starts to think for himself or herself. You see, there's an analogy between these three stages with the walking, the speaking, and the thinking, which happens between 0 and 3.
Hmm. Very interesting.
It's all an archetype of threefoldness, yeah?
So what would you say is the principle that kind of describes this? And in one sense, I get this idea, you know, as above, so below. That concept,
yeah, exactly.
That the macrocosm is a reflection down to in the microcosm. So our life,
exactly,
has the same process as the life above us, so to speak. Is that,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Mm. So the third phase then is completed at 21. And at 21, then the human ego, the human self, the self-autonomous individual. It's like as if, Henrik, you had a house built, you bought a house, and then you move into the house, and now it's your house.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't made it a home yet. It's not yet a home, but you've got the key, and now there you are in this new house at 21. This house you've been building for the past 21 years, or has rather been built with you and by you and for you, now you are the master of it.
And now it's time to furnish the house, as it were.
Exactly, to make it a home, do you see?
Yes.
And this is the significance of the 21 and the 21st century. And I don't have to tell you, I mean, you've got so much on the Red Eye site, it's incredible, that from all kinds of perspectives, many, many people today are aware of the specialness of this time.
Yes.
of the specialness of this period of time we are living in, yeah? That they're aware above all that this is a global consciousness, a global society, a global situation we're in now. And that's why it is truly existential. Because the problems that we face are problems that affect the whole of humanity and the very physical nature of the planet itself, you see? Mm. So this is why the ego, the 21st century in that sense, is really the century of the ego of man, or the ego of the human being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? The human being has come into his, her, its egohood in this 21st century. And that is something which is so to speak, inscribed in history, I would say.
And that's nothing nothing bad. There's nothing wrong with that, because as anything, as you described before, there's certain sets of progress that we need to go through, or different periods that we need to go through in order to become ourselves, basically, and fully manageable or fully come into our own being, as it were. Because what you're describing with the ego, many would say, yes, definitely we're in a more egotistic society, and that's a bad thing. But on the other hand, I think that a lot of that's a necessary process for our learning to go through, right?
Absolutely, Henrik. I'm not using ego in a negative sense at all.
Sure.
I'm saying, you know, it's absolutely necessary in this age of freedom that you know, the human being must be able to stand on our own spiritual feet. And that brings me very much to the question of the New World Order, you see, because...
Yes.
The question there is, yeah, that one can see right from the beginning. I mean, as I said before, I mean, about churchianity, Christ did not found any church.
That's right.
He basically said to the disciples, you're my brothers, yeah?
Yeah.
And so there's no sense in which you have a hierarchy and a church. He was not about founding that. These are things from the pre-Christian ancient world. With the Christian, I would say that with the Christian impulse, you get the greatest impulse to brotherhood. It wasn't the first. Buddha had already created in his communities, his sangha, this sense of a cosmopolitan community. But because that was in Asia, there was still very, very strongly this feeling of the great being is infinitely far above me. There was no sense in which Buddha said to his disciples, you're my brothers and sisters. The sense of worshipping the elder, for example, is so powerful in Asia that was, you know, it's still the case today. In the Buddhist and Hindu world. You see what I mean?
Yes.
In regard to the master, the guru, the teacher, and so on.
Mm.
But in the West, or in the modern, well, I prefer not to say the West anymore. I prefer to say this new impulse which comes for humanity as a whole. This is truly an impulse of brotherhood. Nothing to do with hierarchy. So, when we see the hierarchy that the church attempted to perpetuate after the 12th and 13th centuries, what is that hierarchy? It is a hierarchy in which the church was carrying on certain habits which were, in essence, pre-Christian, do you see?
Yes.
These go back for thousands of years, yeah? And I know there are all sorts of theories about where these come from, but I'd just like to bring in something from the anthroposophical perspective, which is not discussed by various... various alternative thinkers in this sense.
Right.
And that is that Rudolf Steiner felt that the thing that he really had to bring forward very much in the modern world, and this has to do again a bit with this relationship between Christianity and Buddhism, because Buddhism still reckons with reincarnation, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And that is the idea of karma and reincarnation. That the time has been coming since 1800, very slowly at first, but since the 1960s, faster and faster, that the Western world is now beginning to become familiar again with the concept of reincarnation, the concept of previous lives. And that means, who then are these guys in the New World Order?
Yeah.
That when we look at the phenomenon of the New World, see, Steiner's idea was, Henrik, that history is actually not what the Marxists say. It's not abstractions. It's not the dialectic. It's not the movement of class consciousness. It's not dialectical materialism. It's not these kind of gray abstractions. Yeah? History is the deeds of beings. concrete beings, and whether these concrete beings are concrete spiritual beings or concrete human beings, we are also spiritual beings, but they are beings. And that means that beings have intentions, and then they act out on these intentions. So wherever we look in history, we're not looking at abstractions and waves and movements, so to speak, but we're looking at the deeds of beings in relationship with each other.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah?
So that means then, when we look at a phenomenon like the New World Order and the people who are working within it, then we have to ask ourselves, who are these people? We've got to see what impulses do they carry? In what ways do they operate? What attitudes do they have to the people they operate with, to their own subordinates, and to humanity in general? How do they regard for them, for example, do we see them as regarding humanity as a flock, as the church used to do, or as the Egyptian pharaohs and the priests of ancient times would do? Yeah. Now, I don't see that, again, as a negative thing. The child between the age of 7 and 14 requires authority. The child wants a healthy authority from its parents. And that's what the parents should give a child.
Yeah.
Safety, nothing sadistic, but safe, clear authority, so the child can feel safe and grow up within that feeling of safety between those years. Yeah. But from puberty onwards, the child needs freedom. And the point, if one takes into consideration the idea of reincarnation, one can think then that working in a new world, within a new world order, are not only conscious initiates, people who, for example, in their previous lives would have been conscious initiates and hierophants of one kind or another, but also people who would have been their disciples, their pupils, who would be less conscious, who would be semi-conscious, or would be almost entirely unconscious, but who would carry those impulses from a previous life into this.
So they're fulfilling a role here.
Exactly. So they would feel that they still need, for whatever reason it may be, that they have not picked up, for example, on, say, what Steiner would call the Christ impulse, this impulse to brotherhood. You see, this impulse to freedom and brotherhood. That they hadn't picked up on that, so that they return to Earth, and he basically says that we have approximately, in the norm, two incarnations every 2,160 years. So in each different age, you have two incarnations, once in general, once as a man, once as a woman. And so you might come back, you know, 2,000 years later, a lot has happened in the meantime, but you carry on a certain impulse, yeah? Which then leads you to behave in a certain way. And this means that we need to look very carefully at what lives in the will and the way that certain individuals, take for example an individual like David Rockefeller or Zbigniew Brzezinski or these kind of people, how they operate in the world, how they behave. Yeah. So this element of considering personal reincarnation is an important one, particularly because we in the West, we don't see that any. We tend not to see that. And so we can easily think, well, the New World Order phenomenon is just, well, it could either be aliens, you know, the Nibiru thesis, for example.
Sure, sure.
Or it could be, you know, it's just these power-hungry Babylonian priests and their descendants, their bloodline descendants, that is. Yeah, but it's not necessarily a bloodline at all. You see what I'm saying?
So this could be that they are. This is how they manage to keep the agenda going for such a long period. In one sense, we could look at it that they're actually reincarnating back in again, in one sense, and their role is to perpetuate this structure and this system for the purpose of our evolution, if you will.
Absolutely so, Hendrik. And Steiner pointed out during the First World War, for example. He pointed out, we're looking at the Western, what he called the Western Brotherhoods of that time, because he gave a remarkable course of lectures. I'd like to just mention this for your listeners if they get hold of it. This course of lectures is called The Karma of Untruthfulness. The Karma of Untruthfulness is in two volumes. And it was like a kind of applied media course, you could say, for the people of his time, helping them to try to understand the signs of the times, even in the press, the popular literature and so on and so forth, of, you know, what, what was, for example, the First World War all about? How had that come about, that phenomenon? And he was helping the people to see, to understand what was working within the movements of the time. And one of the points he referred to was how that war had been set up. And this is really how I sort of, in a sense, I got into all of this, because I was very interested in the First World War, as I said earlier, in the first hour. And I'd never been satisfied with the causes of the academic explanations of the causes of the war, do you see? And so when I came across his thoughts, these were thoughts which were so, they were so interesting and so radical and coming from such a different perspective, and were so stimulating, that I wanted to follow this through and see if I could bear these out. And so one of the things he referred to was, well, two things actually. One was that the war, you could trace back certain maps, hence later my book Mapping the Millennium, to the late 19th century in the Western Brotherhoods, which were looking forward, as it were, to the Great War. That was one point. And the second point was, and that these brotherhoods carried out certain ceremonial rituals by which they were able to stay in touch with their members who had crossed the threshold, who had died. So they were able to stay in touch with the members of their former lodges, if you will. So you see there's a spiritual chain, therefore, is continued between the generations, so the living and the dead. And this is something else which some researchers have found difficult to understand, the very question you just asked. How is it that this goes on for such a long time, do you see? So this is one of the points he raises in those lectures. But the maps question, when he referred to these maps, you see, and then I also I thought to myself, well, can one see any evidence today? And this is the late 80s. I was thinking this. I read those books of his in 1988. I said, can one see any evidence of this today? Of these. Of these maps or the way these ideas are mediated to the public. And I came across in 1990 a very, very interesting map, which you'll find on my website, in The Economist. And I've now been – The Economist is a magazine which is really, I think – is very, very deeply connected with all of this. And you'll find in Bilderberg sites, for example, that The Economist is the only magazine that is allowed to post rapporteurs at Bilderberg meetings, for example. By which I mean rapporteur. I don't know why they use that Frenchified word, but obviously it means reporter. They always call them rapporteur. But obviously there are heads of media companies attending Bilderberg. That's not what I mean. I mean people who are there, as it were, note takers, I suppose, and who then report back. The only problem is they don't report back to their readers.
Yeah, that's right.
They only report to the people who are there, you see. But it means that a magazine like The Economist always knows what's going on in detail at Bilderberg meetings, because they have their guys at each one of those meetings, and that's been the case for years and years and years. So to gain these are people, in my view, who really understand the score, what's going on from the new world order perspective. And I would just flag up two things, Henrik, because I'm aware of time, in this connection. One is the Economist, The Economist magazine, and if your readers, again, can read about this on my website, The Economist magazine of the week of the first week of September 1990, and I analyze this in detail in my book, Mapping the Millennium. That, by the way, of course, is the week of 9/11, 1990, and that's when that is when George Bush Sr. announced the New World Order.
Indeed.
Yeah, in that particular week, and in that issue, The Economist put forward a remarkable 16-page spread on the emerging scenario, and we're now global scenario in the post-Cold War era. Mm-hmm. And they laid out the whole picture, which we have now become familiar through from works like Clash of Civilizations by Huntington and Grand Chessboard by Brzezinski and so on. This was already there, Henrik, in 1990 mm-hmm. in The Economist, you see. Mm. That shows you how connected these people were. Yeah? Huntington's book didn't come out in Foreign Affairs. I think it was until 93, and then his book a year or two later. Yeah, but there it is in The Economist, in essence, namely that the world, the struggle in the 21st century, will not be a struggle based on economics, such as capitalism versus communism, but it will be a struggle based on culture and religion. Mm. In other words, spirit and ideas. Yeah, and that relates very much to perhaps I should come back to that later, but it's just that they are working, Henrik, with half-truths. They're working with something which is spiritually true, but they're giving it a spin. Mm, and that has to do with the fact that since the 1880s, we have indeed been living in an age of spirit and ideas, and that's called in the esoteric world, the Age of Michael. The age of the Archangel Michael. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The signature of that age is cosmopolitanism and spiritualization of thinking. Whereas the signature of the previous age, the age of the Archangel Gabriel, which is approximately 350 odd years, was a time when human beings were focused particularly on this world, of the physical world. And so you have the natural science developing, you have the technology developing, you have nationalism developing, you have material culture developing, all kinds of ways. That was these archangels, Gabriel and Michael, are sort of archetypes in a sense for birth and death, you see. A concern with this world, the gate of birth coming into this world, which is everything to do with science, natural science. And then Michael's the spiritual sciences, which is where one relates one's thinking not so much to the five senses, but to the world of the invisible.
Mm.
Yeah? So that's the world which we are now living in now, hence the whole New Age phenomenon.
Do you see then that also that this genuine urge in human beings for a new era, if you will, a new spiritual rebirth, as it were, that this is something that is being hijacked by the controlling elements, by the New World Order, because they know, absolutely, as you say, they keep an eye on this, and they know that this is an energy that is coming in one sense, but they want to keep themselves at the top that you described before. But in order to do that, they're going to give us the artificial version of that in order to stay in power themselves. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, that's exactly it, yeah. Mm. And this is, again, Steiner pointed out this in this so-called media course I mentioned, The Karma of Untruthfulness, back in the First World War time. So that's exactly what the United Nations is a very good example of this. League of Nations, United Nations.
Yeah? Yes.
That they understand that living in the will of humanity, living in the modern will of humanity, unconsciously or semi-consciously, is a will for a cosmopolitan world.
Mm.
Is a will to go beyond the world of nation fights against nation.
So how do people, what do you see there? How do people discern here, and how do people know which one is the artificial and the real one, if you know what I mean?
Well, what they have to do, I mean, for example, you'll find many left-wing people and so-called social progressives regard the League of Nations and the United Nations as almost sacrosanct, yeah?
Yeah?
But what you will also find, Henrik, is that these people have not studied the history of it.
Hmm.
If you go in and you look at the history of the League of Nations and the United Nations and you see who is behind it and who are the individuals, it's always individuals. One must look at the individuals, yeah? Who were the individuals who created the British Commonwealth, the individuals who created the United Nations? What were their motivations? Yeah? This is what doesn't happen, Henrik. And if one does that, this is one of the ways in which history can help us, and which is what the truth movement is, which Ian Crane's always talking about. Yeah, Ian's saying this, and many other people. This is part of what the truth movement is. This truth element, you see, remember what I said, karma of untruthfulness that Steiner was saying.
Yeah? Yeah.
That is the Michaelic signature of our time. To find out how the truth about our time is manipulated and spun.
Yes.
So that the forces who are seeking to work against this ego, this will to become a self-autonomous ego of man, at 21, so to speak, those forces which still see themselves, we are the shepherds, we are the patriarchs, you're not grown up yet, you need to be shepherded still. Yeah? Whether it's the Vatican or whether it's the Rockefellers or, you know, whether it's the Chinese Communist Party or whether it's the Dalai Lama, any of these people, yeah, they are still shepherds and they're still working out this shepherding consciousness.
Yep.
We can see, if we use history to study, where these motivations come from, right?
Yeah.
And this does not happen. The people who poo-poo and look down on and dismiss conspiracy theories often do this, Henrik, because they don't study the history of it.
You're
they
right.
don't look yep. at the details and the facts, and they don't go back and make a research of it, right? I'm sure you've heard that before.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just the value of history, do you see?
Yeah.
We're often told that history is irrelevant, you know, well, history causes problems and makes people fight each other. Let's not go there.
Yeah? Right.
But you see what I mean?
Yeah, but how can you learn from your mistakes if you don't know that you've made them or try to, you know, not recognize them, right?
Of course, exactly, yeah. So this is the point that they try to spin. They try to spin things which are, they nudge them in the wrong direction, so to speak. Yeah? Like, for example, something like the United Nations, you see, or the European Union, for that matter. Yeah? So this is how I came into all of this about the maps and the Economist. That's right. Do you mind if I just mention one other point about the Economist?
Of course. I just wanted to ask you before that is where on the website can we read more about the maps? Where do we win? What link?
Well, you can go to the New World Order section, for example.
Okay, very good.
The New World Order section of the
website.
Of the website, and also I've got various miscellaneous articles which don't belong to one of the major sections of the article, but you'll see that on the home page, various miscellaneous articles at the bottom of that front page, and I go into it in those as well.
Very good. Do you want to mention something more about the Economist?
That's right. Well, in the second part of my book, the book is basically in three parts, and the first looked at a map that Steiner referred to, which is from the 1890s already, which is in an English magazine called Truth. Which described how, after a coming world war, Russia would become a socialist state and would become a kind of a desert. Mm. This was in 1890, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1893, for example, there was an Englishman by the name of C.G. Harrison who gave some lectures to the Berean Society. That's B-E-R-E-A-N. For those of your listeners who want to look it up on the website, on the net, but you'll probably have great difficulty finding them. The Berean Society were actually a group of Christian, you call it, people interested in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But this man who gave these lectures, a fascinating and very elusive figure, C.G. Harrison, very difficult to find out anything about him, but somebody who really had deep esoteric and occult knowledge. And he describes that, this is 1893, a whole view of how the Brotherhoods of the West saw the people of the English-speaking nations. They saw themselves as the wet nurses to the Slavonic people, the Slavs, in the same way that the Roman Empire had seen themselves, the Romans and then the Catholic Church, the papacy, had seen themselves as wet nurses to the Germanic peoples.
Mm-hmm.
This means, Henrik, that you have different periods of history, and this goes back to what we were saying before about the age of Aries, the age of Pisces, and the following age of Aquarius, which we are nowhere near in yet. But anyway, in each one of these ages, you have a different culture comes to the fore and plays a particularly significant role. So in the age of Aries, it was the Romans. And in the age of Pisces, it's been what you could call very loosely the Germanics. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
That includes the Germans. It includes the English, includes the Scandinavians, includes the Dutch, the people of Northern Europe. Yeah?
Yes.
The Germanics. And out of them, the Germanics, comes the USA, do you see?
Mm.
So that's the point. The Germanics plus the USA in a certain sense, yeah, and the North Americans. And these are the people who have a particular role to play in this epoch. But the people who have a particular role to play in the next epoch are the Slavic peoples.
Interesting.
And especially the Russians.
Right.
Yeah. And a key goal of the New World Order, I don't know if you remember in 2002, no, sorry, yeah, 2003, early 2003, when the Iraq war was looming and the various European countries were a bit worried about it. And Condoleezza Rice made a very, very interesting statement, which certainly Rudolf Steiner, if he was alive now, would say here is a real symptom, because certain symptoms can show you what lies under the surface. And she said, Condoleezza Rice said, we must punish the French, ignore the Germans, and forgive the Russians. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Punish the French. They were making the strongest criticisms of the Iraq situation.
That's right. Yeah.
We must ignore the Germans. They were also making making certain criticisms, but not quite so vociferous, not so quite so aggressive. And we must forgive the Russians. What they mean, but what that points to, from my reading, is that we must, everything to do with the French belong, the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Latin, the Mediterranean world, the Catholic world, all of that world is the past. It's the fourth epoch. That's the age of Pisces. That's gone. We must suppress that. And everything to do with that era, we must, and any efforts it makes to keep coming up, we must push it down. And the German-speaking world, in particular, we must ignore. We must make sure that no positive or no contributions, no cultural contributions come from that world, but rather only from the English-speaking world. And so this has been a really powerful motif. In this age of Pisces, which started in 1413, in the early 15th century, that the English-speaking world gradually comes to the fore. And first of all, you see the English-speaking world suppress the Spanish, the French. And then it suppresses its Germanic challengers, the Dutch, and then the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And the English-speaking world is determined to go on, Henrik, staying in charge for the rest of this epoch.
Yes.
Then furthermore, because the New World Order, after all, is something which has emerged largely out of the English-speaking world, that this epoch, the mega goal, if you will, is to make sure that the next epoch, the age of Aquarius, in which the Slavic peoples are supposed to bring to the fore particular qualities which they have, this will not happen. That they will not be enabled. They will not be enabled to do that, and that means that Russia must be destroyed. Now, in The Economist of 1993, this is the double issue of 1992-1993. There is a fascinating article which I go into in great detail in the third section of my book, and this article is called "Looking Back from 2992." A World History, Chapter 13, The Disastrous 21st Century. That's the title of this Economist article.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So it's a kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek, and they like to do this in The Economist, slightly humorous, but actually deadly serious, looking back at the 21st century from far, far in the future. But actually, Hendrik, they're not looking back from far, far in the future, because the article only really deals with the 21st century. And not only that, it only really deals with the first half of the 21st century. So they're really only looking from 1992 until about 2050 at the latest, you see.
All right.
And they're laying out what they see is going to happen between that time until 2050. And the main thing that they're putting forward here is that, as they see it, there will be an alliance between the Chinese and the Muslim countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of this alliance between the Chinese and the Muslim countries is that Russia will be destroyed.
Really?
And that Russia will lose everything east of the Urals.
I mean, because this is something that we have been seeing lately as well. You know, Putin has thrown out certain people that was backing him from the get-go. Boris Berezovsky, some of these people have been thrown out seems to be kind of mediators for the West as well, in one sense, and the relationships between the West and the East, or Russia and the U.S., have been taken back a little bit, if you will. I'm just reminded of this strange, I don't know if you recall this or not, but Hillary Clinton was over in Russia a while back. This was in March, and they gave a symbolic button to the Russians which said, reset on the English translation of this, but
yeah,
allegedly this was a translation mistake, which is just ludicrous to me if you think about it. But it meant the word in Russian, they're supposed to be reset, but it actually was overcharged or something like that. That it was like they wanted to reset the relationship again, but it seems like the message here was that we're going to come in with force. This is going to be overcharged, our relationship, if you know what I mean. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, yeah, yes, indeed. Quite so. I mean, I think the thing is, you see, that the Western powers, the particularly the Anglo-American West, they're trying to break up Russia as the bridge between the West and Asia.
Mm.
This is the point, Henrik, yeah, that in the 21st century, what we are seeing is that these great powers, which in a certain sense, these forces of what lives on the American continent and what lives in China, these are two forces which go way, way back in human history and right to the time of Atlantis, which I'm sure we haven't got time to go into now. But these two forces, which go right back to this very ancient time in human history, are now coming right up sort of face to face with each other,
mm-hmm,
in a sense.
Mm-hmm,
yeah? Mm-hmm. And between them is Europe and Africa.
Right.
Yeah, and the question is that these massive forces, represented by the most modern element, in a sense, in historical terms, the America, and one of the most ancient forms of social civilization, the Chinese, is now coming up very powerfully against each other. The Chinese with a very strong we culture,
mm-hmm,
emphasis, and the Americans with a me, myself, and I, which is the sort of what I would call the selfish ego. I mean, I don't wish to put America down. There's a lot of wonderful things happening in the States.
Of course.
But there's obviously nobody would question, I think, for a moment, the fact that America has developed some of the most egocentric aspects of Western egocentrism, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm,
yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a very self-centered I culture and a very powerful we culture are now facing each other. Yeah?
Mm.
Now, Europe has within itself a threefoldness, I would say, Henrik, stretching from Scandinavia through Germany through Italy, north, center, south. That central pole is a central cultural region between the west of Europe, Iberia, France, and the British Isles on the one hand, and then the Eastern Europe on the other. Yeah?
Yes.
And so there's a certain cultural and historical threefoldness in Europe, which one can also see in its religious confessions and many other things. But the point is that Europe has a threefoldness to it. So Europe has an intuitive, if it can only be conscious of it, understanding of what it means to live with a pole and a middle element, do you see?
Yes.
Yeah? Even in Scandinavia you have that.
Yes.
Denmark, Norway, Sweden. You know, if one thinks, what is the relationship of those three cultures within Scandinavia? You know, what particular qualities do they have? How are they different from each other, and so on? Mm. It's a very interesting threefoldness, even there on a smaller scale.
Yes.
But Europe has it as a whole. Now, Russia, I beg your pardon, Germany used to be in that position very strongly within Europe until 1945. And in 1945, Germany was then split.
Yep.
And Europe, instead of being a threefoldness, became a twofoldness, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the danger, this reduction of the threefoldness to the twofoldness. And this is one of my sort of themes which I go into quite a lot about in relation to the number 23, which has to do with this reduction of the three to the two,
mm-hmm,
from Trinity to dualism, if you will.
Right, right. Interesting.
And again, this connects up with computers and all of that. You know, you think of the computer consciousness, think, do. Exactly.
Yes.
Binary. There's no reflective heart.
Hmm. Very good.
There
point.
Is no silent, quiet, reflective heart. Yeah. And that is the essence of humanity. The human pole and the will pole, what we have in our guts and what we have in our brains, there's something compulsive about those two poles, yeah?
Mm.
But the free space relies in the human heart forces, I would say. Anyway, the question is, the goal of those forces which work against the human being is always to reduce the three to the two and get rid of the middle term.
Mm.
To get rid of the middle element, whatever it is, wherever it is, whenever it is. So, there was a certain war against the Central European element. I don't say only Germany, but I mean also war against, for example, what the Austro-Hungarian Empire was, or what it could have become.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
and a reduction of Europe from 3 to 2. And now we see Russia, you see. Russia is on the global scale. You're in its Eurasian quality. It's the only part of the West, Henrik, which really understands, or at least understands a lot better, the Asians than the Europeans do. Certainly than the Americans do.
Yeah.
And so the goal of these forces in the Anglo-American West now is to make sure, not only to make, is to make sure that Russia is, how can I put it, chronically weakened, whether it be in its genetic stock, whether it be in the breakdown of its social order, whether it be in the breakdown of its spiritual life, and even in its political and state form. So they wish to reduce Russia back to what it used to be in the days of Ivan the Terrible. That means west of the Urals.
And again, I think that this we can see this in the way that the so-called Russian satellite states have been taken over as well by Western forces. Again, you have all these color revolutions, Georgia, Ukraine, and so forth, and they're trying to make them more into, well, they say pro-European or whatever, but in many cases I see that also that NATO is there, meaning that the U.S. forces are there, you know, in that sense. You know, there's just something to that, that they're trying to decimate or grab a little piece here and there all the time of what formerly was the Soviet Union or you know, Russia.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, Henry, I mean, I wouldn't want your listeners to get me wrong. You know, I'm not saying Putin is a great man or Russia is a perfect society or anything like that.
Sure.
Even the Russians themselves, if you go back to Russian writing in the 19th century, they were aware that there was something, there was a waiting element about their culture. There was a young element about it which hadn't come yet, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There was a future-oriented element to it, do you see?
Yeah.
And I would say that's still the case now. Russia is still finding itself, finding its way forward, and that's why it's going through certain painful processes. But if the West were to try to emasculate, were to try to undermine and sap the energies of Russia in such a way that Russia and the Slavic world could not contribute to humanity, because every human culture has a go at this. Every human culture has a chance to contribute something to humanity at a certain point in history. If the Russians and the Slavs are not able to contribute in the next epoch, which won't be from the fourth millennium, 3573, won't be able to do that, then that will have severe consequences. So Steiner's emphasis was that the West and the Russians themselves must not allow the connection between the center of Europe and that also includes Scandinavia, by the way, and I'm thinking of Sweden as well here, that the connection between the center of Europe and Russia to be broken. Because this connection between the center of Europe and the east of Europe, center of Europe and Russia, is very, very important for the future. And the West wishes that, when I say the West, I mean the elite forces in the West, wish to do precisely that, so that there will be another binary created, you see. If Asia comes up to the Urals, Henrik, as is described in this Economist article, if Muslim forces and Chinese forces take over the whole of Siberia, and the Russians who live there are forced out, and Russia then comes back west of the Urals, then the Anglo-American forces will seek to draw Russia into the EU in such a way that the EU and America will become one, one transatlantic unit.
Yes.
The Oceania, if you will, the Oceania of
1984.
Exactly, writ large. Yeah?
Yes.
And that we see signaled in the in these two economists I've referred to from the early 90s, and we can see that happening step by step, day by day, week by week, of how in all kinds of ways the American and the British and the European elite are trying to weave and knit together North America and the European Union. And this is for another binary struggle, an almighty binary struggle, Henrik, in the 21st century, between this world of the West and the world represented by China.
It's very, very interesting listening to this. It's a kind of what you're describing here, is that there needs to, at this particular time, also then come in a balance into this these two, the binary forces and the power that is involved in when these forces are kind of fighting each other, if you will. And this is about, I guess, also in one sense, preventing. Because many people now in this day, they see kind of almost like a looming catastrophe if we don't manage to get a hold of the situation. Because on one sense, it feels like it could you know, erupt in war or what have you, or, you know, world, another world war in that sense. But do you see that, do you see a positive trend here? Do you see something that points to the fact that, we won't have, this binary system much longer? Or do you think that the forces of the West and the elite of the West will prevail and actually keep Russia decimated or low, as it were?
Well, Henrik, one of the things which in the history of the West has been incredibly difficult to understand has been the concept of Trinity, which is threefoldness. And if you follow the history of what is called esoteric Christianity, and I would argue that not enough attention is paid to that in alternative circles, there is rather an interest only in the ancient pre-Christian wisdom of the Near and Far East, so to speak, or mm-hmm. But if one follows this and one sees how, for example, in the 18th century, you see the idea of liberty, equality, fraternity come forward, but it came forward only in an abstract sense. And Europe was not able to make anything of that in any real way in the 19th century. And so we got all the problems of Marxism. Steiner tried in the 20th century to bring forward this idea of threefoldness into actual social reality, in actually grounding it not only in the nature of the human being, where is the threefoldness in me as a human, individual human being, but where is it in society, where is it in culture, and can we create a society on the basis of threefold culture? For example, just I'm aware of time, so I'll make this very short, yeah? Mm-hmm. Our present problem, so much of it is caused by the fact that our economic realm is interfered with by our political realm and vice versa. The economic realm interferes with the spiritual cultural realm and vice versa. The Vatican tries to interfere with the political realm. These three realms, this is the threefoldness, you see?
Yeah.
Liberty in the spiritual cultural realm, equality in the political realm, and brotherhood and fraternity in the economic realm. These three realms must be clarified, and we must realize that they have their separate places. We must disentangle them. So many of our problems are caused by the fact that we've got so much, they're all mixed up. Mm. For example, think of the recent American election and how much money was spent on that. You see? Or one of Steiner's most radical ideas, for example, was we need to separate labor from work. Labor from money. Yeah, the mm-hmm, idea mm-hmm. that, for example, you can be paid for your time. The idea that one human being's life, the time of one human being's life, is worth more than another human being's life.
Right.
How do you quantify, you know, whether your time, Henrik, is worth, you know, 1,000 kroner or 1,500 kroner, whatever it is?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and how do you quantify what somebody's life, somebody's time, you see?
Yep.
So he would say, well, we've got to look at ways in which the economic realm and the political realm are differentiated and separated so that then they can be reintegrated and harmonized in a way that's in a way analogous, not exactly the same, but analogous to the way in which our nerve system, our heart-lung system, and our metabolic system harmoniously operate within the human organism. Yeah,
well,
they're separate, but they're harmonious.
Right. Well, it's a very good point. We need the whole body, and you need all the elements for a healthy body, and for, you know, if we use the body again as an analogy for, well, the planet or the culture that we're in, or you know, life basically. So it's a very good
That's
analogy.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. It's we've got to become familiar with this threefoldness within the human being and within society. This would be a way to overcome this threatening binaries, you see.
And so
but that means that Europe has to become aware of itself mm-hmm. as a threefold entity too.
And so this is the challenge, I guess, also then for us living in this third millennium, as it were, when things potentially could go either to pieces or that we actually end up in the right way and prosper after this point, if you know what I mean.
Exactly, Henry. We're moving from the second millennium to the third millennium. We're
yes.
moving from the two to the three.
Yeah.
Even there, you see. So the question is, in this third millennium, one needs to see how this threefold picture could come about. And a symptom of that is when Tony Blair was in office, if you remember, with Bill Clinton, they started talking about the third way.
Yes.
Remember that,
yes.
yeah? And for a time, there was a lot of talk about the third way, yeah? But all they meant by the third way was simply putting the old capitalism and the old socialism together.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not,
creating a third.
That's not the third way. and promptly, many people in the elite-sponsored media then sort of poured scorn on this and said, well, actually, there is no third way. There is only, you know, the way of Anglo-American free market capitalism.
Hmm. So that's, so that is the artificial version that we're being offered again then.
Yes, exactly so. Hmm. So it's, and yet this present economic crisis has revealed, you see, as everybody's recognizing, that, that this isn't going anywhere either.
No.
So the binary of capitalism, communism has failed. And so now is the time, above all, when, as I said before, the human being, comes through these three phases, yeah, from 7 to 14 to 21,
mm-hmm.
that we've come to this ego point in the history of humanity. And now is this point where we have to realize that this threefold ego, the threefold element within the human being needs to be reflected within the society.
Mm-hmm.
Steiner made the point that, you know, in the one of the reasons why things didn't work out in the 19th century was that in around about the early 19th century, that they had these remarkable concepts about the human being, but they remained very abstract and they couldn't be grounded in such a way that they could be applied concretely to the specific realms. And that was a key problem at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to make these now specific. And it's actually, if people can actually start to think of in that sense and start to work with these threefold ideas, then they could start to see how these different realms interfere with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how the state, for example, is constantly interfering with education. I don't know how it is in Sweden, but it's a nightmare in Britain. How education is always a political football.
Yeah, same
and
here.
Yet, yeah?
Yeah?
Is it the same in Sweden?
Yeah.
Steiner's point was, you know, if teachers are going to raise free-thinking human beings, then the state has to get out of the heads of teachers.
That's right.
You know, teachers have to be free.
Yeah.
Teachers have to be free to teach freely so that kids can be free, you know,
that's right.
And think freely. But the state is telling us here in England what teachers should teach and has been doing that since the early 80s. When the British government said, well, how can we improve our economic efficiency against the Japanese? Well, we have to have the same kind of system that the Japanese have, which is lockstep, you see, and governed by the state.
But
everybody studying the same book at the same time or the same curriculum. It's not quite that bad now, but still the state basically tells the teachers what to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is very, very fascinating, and I'd love at some point here soon to have you back again, because I know that there's so much more that we will not have time to go into here today, among other things, the importance of the European Union, even going to some more information about Caspar Hauser, which is another area, another interesting person that you talk and write about, and then, of course, even more actually background on Steiner, you know, the Waldorf system potentially, and anthroposophy as well, you know.
Anthroposophy,
Anthroposophy, mm-hmm. Sorry, yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that this is a good place here, Terry, to begin to round things up here for this time. Is there anything more you'd like to leave us with before we mention your website and so forth again?
No, I think you've already done it, Henrik. Yeah, it's been really pleasure. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely. And again, then I want to highlight four people that are interested in hearing more from you, that you will be speaking at the Alternative View in London at the end of May. The website for tickets, times, dates, etc. is thealternativeview.co.uk. And then Terry's own website is Monju. That's Monju. .pwp.blueyonder.co.uk. This will be linked up on our website as well. And again, the book is called Mapping the Millennium: Behind the Plans of the New World Order. And it's available on Amazon. Is that correct, Terry?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Well, okay, thank you very much again for joining us here today. And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing you in London as well then.
Okay, Henrik. Me too. I look forward to seeing you there. All the best.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye now.
That's our program with Terry Boardman. Thank you very much for joining us in the members area. And my thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. We will be back on Sunday with Andy Thomas. In the meantime, we'll see you online. Take good care. Bye-bye.